Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week was born in Kentucky, grew up in Cedar Falls, Iowa. She earned a B.S. in chemistry from Grinnell College and a doctorate of philosophy in biochemistry from the University of North Carolina. From 2002 to 2014, she served as the 13th president of the University of Michigan and was its first female president. In 2009, Time magazine ranked her as one of the 10 best American university presidents, citing her success in fundraising and emphasis on research. Her name? Dr. Mary Sue Coleman. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to the 13th president of the University of Michigan and its first female president, Dr. Mary Sue Coleman. Doctor, welcome. An honor to have you.
Thank you very much, Jack. I'm pleased to be with you.
Can we start by talking about your childhood, your mom and your dad, please?
Well, I had fabulous parents. My mother was an elementary school teacher, very inventive, and she loved teaching children because she said they were so curious. My dad was a chemistry and physics professor at the University of Northern Iowa for most of his career. And he was just a tremendous role model for me. So I had a supportive and wonderful parents, and I was deeply grateful.
What's the biggest thing you learned from Dad, and what's the biggest thing you learned from Mom?
Well, from my father, I learned that you will have disappointments in life and that you need to address those, and probably those disappointing times make you stronger. And it's not good to have success all the time. So he was just wonderful because he understood that I was going to be a scientist. And as a scientist, I could talk science to him. My mother just was so courageous. Back in the 1930s, when she was a young woman and very adventurous, so she taught me to be brave, I think. And both of them were, I was lucky, they were wonderful parents.
All right, you earned a B.S. in chemistry from Grinnell College and then a doctorate of philosophy in biochemistry from the University of North Carolina, Tar Heel. Mary Sue, I'm from the south side of Chicago. We didn't know what biochemistry was. What is biochemistry?
So, Jack, interestingly enough, when I was in college, I didn't really understand what biochemistry was either. I majored in chemistry because I knew that. You know, my dad was a chemist. What I learned, actually, as a senior and got pretty excited about it, is that what biochemistry is the chemistry of living things. And so I took my knowledge of chemistry, learned some biology, and realized that for me, what was most exciting was understanding how living things function at a chemical level. I guess that's the easiest way to describe it. It was exciting, exciting time and science and exciting for me.
The only constant in life is change. So over the last 50 years, how has biochemistry changed?
It has been a complete revolution. That is, once back in the early 1950s, when Watson and Crick discovered the double helix of DNA, that is, that DNA was the essence of life, how cells replicated, how they divided, how just these are the basic tenets of how life evolves. And since then, and tools have been developed, that it's been a complete revolution in biology, biochemistry, and chemistry as well. And so we are in an exciting time for what is possible now to detect and cure diseases. Make life better, which is one of the goals, I think, of all of science, is to make life better.
All right. For 19 years, You're on the biochemistry faculty at the University of Kentucky, Lexington, Kentucky. Talk about that chapter of your life.
Well, I enjoyed very much being in the biochemistry department. It was in a medical school, so I was able to teach undergraduates interested in science. I taught graduate students who were studying for their master's and PhDs in biochemistry, but I also taught medical students who were learning biochemistry because they needed to understand this chemistry of life to understand what they were doing in medicine. And I found the students were always interesting, bringing new ideas. I was doing research, so I had students in my laboratories that I was teaching. One of the things I loved about students, sometimes they ask a question that, well, is so simple, but it actually takes you in a completely different direction. Sometimes people who know too much about a subject won't think about that simple question that opens up a whole new area. And I just found that so delightful. I loved it.
All right. While you were there at University of Kentucky, you published widely on enzyme function in immunology and cancer. So as the decades have gone by, what's amazed you the most about our advances in cancer treatment?
Well, since we understand so much more now about how cancer cells function, how they grow, how they metastasize, and understanding that basic chemistry of those cells has meant that we could find new targets and new ways to stop cancer cells from dividing and multiplying and still save the normal cells. So that's what you have to do. You have to target the cancer cell and not destroy the normal cells. And we've gotten so much better about that because now we really understand the differences and what are the things that are going to help stop that cancer growth. So it's really amazing what's happened over the last 50 years.
Synonymous with Kentucky, when you hear Kentucky, you think thoroughbreds, bourbon, and college basketball. Were you wild for the Wildcats when you were a professor at the University of Kentucky?
I think everybody who lives in Kentucky loves the Wildcats. Our son, Jonathan, was a big Kentucky basketball fan. And it was very exciting, but there was also an underbelly there because while I was still there, there was a cheating scandal with Kentucky basketball, and that was a very painful period because we didn't want to believe it was true, but it was.
We're talking to Mary Sue Coleman. When we come back, we're going to ask her about the chapter of her life at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Crisula, and we're with Dr. Mary Sue Coleman. From 1990 to 1993, you and your family were in Chapel Hill, Raleigh, North Carolina, because you taught at the University of North Carolina. Talk about that chapter.
Yes, Chapel Hill, North Carolina. We're in the Research Triangle, but not in Raleigh. I was recruited to North Carolina because one of the things that I had learned in my latter years at University of Kentucky was that I really enjoyed the administrative aspects of building a department, building a university, making it better. And so at that, I moved my laboratory to North Carolina, but it gave me an opportunity over those 3 years to decide whether I wanted to give up the research aspect and move into more administrative roles at the university. I was recruited as Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UNC Chapel Hill. And it was just a very exciting time, and I was able to make the decision then that I wanted to go into a larger role at the university rather than stay a faculty member.
All right, tell us about the Tar Heel basketball.
It was pretty exciting. I remember one of the first games that we went to, that Ken and I went to, my husband went to, was right after we had moved to Chapel Hill, and it turned out that UNC was playing the University of Kentucky.
Oh.
And we had divided loyalties because we had cheered for Kentucky basketball for so long. And here we were at a different institution, and we needed to learn how to cheer for the Tar Heels. But we did. It was great.
Okay. From 93 to 95, you, Ken, and Jonathan went down to New Mexico, and you were the provost at the University of New Mexico. That chapter, please.
Well, I knew that if I wanted to advance in an administrative career, that the next step after my role at Chapel Hill was to take on the role as provost, because the provost is the chief academic officer for universities. All the deans of the colleges report to the provost. I was attracted to New Mexico. My husband, Ken, a Latin Americanist, was very interested in going to a region of the country that had a lot of relationships with Latin America, and New Mexico did. So it was an exciting time. New Mexico is an institution that doesn't have a lot of resources, at least it didn't when we went there. And I learned how to manage in an environment where you have to be very careful about the investments that you make as provost, because you're not going to have unlimited amounts of money to spend. And I learned a lot there. It's a very, very diverse place. A lot of Native American culture, Hispanic culture, Latin American culture, Anglo culture. And I learned so much there. It was vital, I think, for the rest of the stops that I had in my career.
All right, speaking of stops in your career, in 1995, you go back home and you become the 18th president of the University of Iowa and the first female to serve as such. What was that like?
Well, it was going home for both Ken and me. Ken is a native Iowan. He spent all of his growing up life there. I had moved there and went to high school and college in Iowa. And it just seemed like the perfect location for us. We knew the state. We understood that the University of Iowa had an acclaimed writing program, the Writers' Workshop. A lot of things we admired about the University of Iowa, part of the Big Ten Conference, Athletic Conference. And it was a homecoming for us. Ken had relatives who still lived in Iowa, and we enjoyed that very much. Becoming a president was certainly a big step, and I knew that I would have a big learning curve going to the presidency, but it was the right move for us.
What was the biggest challenge you had to face in those 7 years at Iowa?
Well, the biggest thing that I worked on, I had many issues, of course. What I discovered about being a university president is that the issues and the problems find you. You can't really go in with an agenda that you think nothing is going to change that, because there are issues. And one of the things that I had to convince the governing board about is that the University of Iowa had a very different mission than Iowa State University, also an important state institution, and the University of Northern Iowa, because Iowa had a huge health system. And the cost basis for running the University of Iowa was very different from those other two institutions that were part of a system of higher education. So I worked tirelessly for several years to get a tuition differential. A larger tuition for Iowa, because it cost more to go to Iowa. It cost more for Iowa to educate students than the other two institutions. And I was finally able to get that implemented, much to the benefit of the University of Iowa. But there were other problems and issues that I faced. I worked closely with the legislature in the state of Iowa and had good relationships with many people in the state of Iowa. And I thought that was a very satisfying and wonderful institution to lead.
Share with us, you mentioned that University of Iowa had this huge relationship with this huge healthcare system. I believe that the football stadium, that there's a children's hospital, or at least a wing, almost as part of that football stadium. What happens every football weekend at that stadium?
Well, you're probably talking about the Wave. This got started kind of by accident. I think it was the, I think Kirk Ferentz's wife had decided that it might be very nice in the end of first quarter, I think it's when it happens, that the children and their parents are sitting up in the top floor of that children's hospital that overlooks the stadium. And so the football team and everybody in the stadium stops at the end of the first quarter and waves to all the children and their parents who are standing up, sort of peering from that top level in the hospital down on the middle of the stadium. It's just a charming tradition, and I'm so happy that it's happened. It did not happen when I was there, but that's been a subsequent sort of tradition that they follow, and I think it's terrific.
All right, let's jump to March Madness 2025. And the Final Four is Kentucky, North Carolina, Iowa, and the Wolverines. Dr. Mary Sewell Coleman, who are you rooting for?
No question, Michigan.
Who comes in second?
Probably Iowa.
All right. We won't hold you to that. So, okay, we're talking to Mary Sewell Coleman. Back in 2002, left Iowa and came to Ann Arbor. We'll ask her how and why. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula, and we're with an amazing lady, Dr. Mary Sewell Coleman. Let's go back 2002. You leave Iowa, and you move to Ann Arbor. How and why?
Jack, I really did not believe that I would ever leave Iowa. I thought I would probably sort of spend my entire career there. But at one point, the University of Michigan came calling. The search committee for president wanted to talk to me. And the reason that I decided that I wanted to talk to them was my admiration for the University of Michigan in defending itself against lawsuits about affirmative action. I thought that the research that the university had done about the benefits of diversity for all students in the classroom and their staunch sort of use of a tool that I believe had been very, very effective just made me admire them so much. Once I met the search committee and I saw how dedicated and committed everybody was at University of Michigan, I knew that this was the place I wanted to be, and it has been the highlight of my life.
And as soon as that search committee sat down and listened to you, they knew that you should be the 13th president in the history of the University of Michigan, and also the first female president. Okay, arguably the most iconic college fight song in America. Notre Dame would disagree. USC would disagree. But hail to the victors. Dr. Coleman, as the president, you heard that song played thousands of times. Thousands. When you heard it play, what did you think about and what did you do?
You know, I have never grown tired of that song. I love it. And I believe that it's the best. I mean, I would disagree with Notre Dame. It's the best fight song. I mean, because it's an aspirational. You know, it's about so many important things about the institution. And so for me, it means a lot. I think that that Block M design, sometimes you're in very strange places in the world, and if you're wearing a Block M t-shirt, you know, you'll hear Go Blue from somebody.
All right, Go Blue. And you say that the song is the best song. Well, some would say that the best professors are at U of M, the best students are at U of M, and some might ask, what does a president do all day when she's the president of the University of Michigan?
Well, Jack, the other thing about Michigan that's so astonishing to me is the breadth and depth of the academic disciplines at Michigan are unparalleled. Just, they're unparalleled. I mean, when we were thinking about coming to Michigan, my husband and I looked across, you know, all the departments and the disciplines and where they were sort of ranked in excellence in their professors and students and the research that they did. And we discovered that only Berkeley and Michigan are kind of in that top league. The thing about Michigan, though, that's different from Berkeley is that we have this wonderful health system that has all these biomedical disciplines that Berkeley doesn't have. The other astonishing thing about Michigan that people don't realize is our high success rate in student graduation. We are close to 95% graduation rate, which really does rival the best private institutions in the country. We do it at scale. The Ivy League institutions that have those very high graduation rates are tiny compared to Michigan. We have over 50,000 students. So we do excellence at scale in a way that no other institution in the country does.
Speaking of excellence at scale, you're also within a couple minutes of Zingerman's. So, the best. Okay, some of your key accomplishments. You brought the Life Sciences Institute to fruition. Talk about that, please.
Well, that was exciting to me, and it was a challenge that the Board of Regents had. They were very concerned about it because they had invested enormous sums in building a new building and recruiting scientists. And when my predecessor left, when Lita Bollinger left, they were very concerned that the Life Sciences Institute would not be able to achieve what they had hoped. So that was one of my first tasks. And what I decided was that the way to really bring it to the kind of excellence that we knew it could have was to start with some anchoring the building and laboratories with some current Michigan professors. And then we would use those professors to recruit people from other institutions. We decided to recruit young, promising people because it's very hard to move established scientists. Both of those strategies worked beautifully. And yep. it's been a real gem for the University of Michigan and continues to be a gem because of the number of people that it's produced. Some of them have left. New people have been recruited. But it just adds to the sort of strong research base that the University of Michigan has in the biomedical sciences.
And that gem is named today Mary Sue Coleman Hall. Well, Mary Sue, when you're driving past it, what's it like seeing your name on the top of a building?
Well, you know, it's a little humbling. I have to say that I was astonished when the Board of Regents decided that they wanted to do that and deeply honored and appreciated. I just love the building. I have a little small retirement office in the building, and it continues just to be a wonderful environment, wonderful place for graduate students for postdoctoral fellows, for faculty, and they continue to do outstanding work.
All right. Another initiative, accomplishment, was you were a founding president of the University Research Corridor, an economic development collaboration with MSU and Wayne State. Please.
That was, I think, a very important development for us in Michigan. And one of the things I had sort of used as a model was the Research Triangle in North Carolina, where North Carolina State, Duke, and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill sort of create a triangle there to create collaborations and get institutions to work together and to recruit companies to come in and utilize actual geographical space that they had. So that was the idea. The three presidents decided that we wanted to use this as a mechanism to go to the legislature to speak about sort of what we did for research for the state, why it was so important. I think that was a pretty effective strategy to get people in the legislature and the state in general to understand what we were bringing to the state. And that's not to say, you know, other institutions that don't do a lot of research in the state are not valuable. They are. They're very valuable. But most of the research that happens in the state happens at those three institutions. And I enjoyed, and I think the other presidents enjoyed, you know, being able to work together. And we hope we created some more collaborative opportunities for our individual faculty. But it was a very exciting time.
All right. Your library had over 7 million books. And you partnered with a young new company. I think its name was Google. Talk about that partnership.
Well, Jack, that was a really interesting time because early in my presidency, I was visited one day by a young, brash fellow named Larry Page. And he walked into my office. And he said his goal was to digitize all the books in the world so that they would be available to all the readers in the world. And I looked at him and I thought, this is crazy. There is no way that, you know, you can photograph, because you have to photograph every page in the book to digitize it, that this can't work. So a few months later, the head of the library came to talk to me and Paul Courant, who was the provost then, and they were putting this plan on the table that we should do this. Well, I said, you're going to have to demonstrate to me how this is going to work. So they set up a warehouse in over by the athletic fields at the university and brought in all of these big camera apparatus and showed me that, yes, you have to have people standing at the cameras flipping the pages on the book. But in fact, if you have enough cameras and enough people, that it is possible to digitize 7 million volumes in about 8 months. And they proceeded, and the University of Michigan was the first institution in the country to agree to digitize all of its holdings. This was contentious because the publishers did not want us to do this. They thought they would lose money. I thought that they would not lose money because they would make people interested in buying those books that they now had some access but not complete access to via digitization. It was exciting.
We're talking to Mary Sue Coleman, and now the truth comes out that Mary Sue Coleman is responsible for all the listeners that have gotten rich on the Google stock. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible on 760 WJR.
You've been listening to your inspirational fireside chat, Anything is Possible, for nearly 20 years.
This is Anything is Possible, and I'm Jack Krasula.
But what has Jack been up to lately? Search at AIP Speaker Series and find out. Jack has interviewed thousands of historical voices, some of whom have offered him their philosophy of life, like Tom Izzo.
And Tom writes, work hard, persistence always wins out, discipline is the highest form of love. Stay humble.
The great Ernie Harwell.
My aim is to do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with God.
And the voices of our generation.
I am reassured continuously that His unfathomable love and mercy are the greatest gifts of my life and my constant source of strength, reassurance, and guidance. His Holiness, Pope Francis.
At AIP Speakers Series is the YouTube channel where all of these jewels can be heard, including some of Anything Is Possible's greatest guests.
And we're with Mitch Albom.
The Little Liar is really a book about truth and lies and the price we pay when we lie.
This is Anything Is Possible, and with Tom Watson.
My father loved to play with the pros at the club, developed a very quick friendship with Stan and played some golf with him. And then he would ask me to play golf with him and Stan.
Our guest this week was born with a rare disorder characterized by the absence of arms and legs. His name, Nick Vujicic.
Something that every human being actually deals with, Jack. It's the choice of continuing to believe or giving up.
And recordings of the AIP Speaker Series events at St. John's Resort. Go to YouTube and search at AIP Speaker Series. It's free. And remember,
anything is possible.
Spohom. I'm Jack Crisula. This is Anything Is Possible. Go into Google and look up Classy and Humble. A picture of Mary Sue Coleman pops up on the Google. So, one more initiative. You raised, you and your team, $3.2 billion, with a B, called the Michigan Difference. How did that happen?
When I...
That's a lot of zeros, Dr. Coleman. That's a lot of zeros.
When I came to Michigan, a capital campaign had been started, but was pretty much in a sort of a, I guess, troubled phase because the president left. And when the president leaves the institution, then donors get nervous, because they don't know, you know, who's going to be recruited and whether that person is going to be able to keep moving the institution forward. And the other thing that happened when I came is that Lee Bollinger recruited the head of development with him to Columbia. So we had a pretty depleted bench when I came. So the first thing I did was to recruit from Ohio State a fellow named Jerry May, who, in my opinion, is the best fundraiser in the country. I had met Jerry when I was at the University of Iowa because I'd invited him to come and speak to the development folks at Iowa. And Iowa has a tremendous development operation. But Jerry was talking about sort of how he organized development at Ohio State and what they did, how successful they were. I knew that Jerry had at one time actually been at the University of Michigan, and in fact, he was a Michigander. So I recruited him to come back to Michigan and to head up development at the University of Michigan, and it was the best decision that I made. Jerry and I worked so closely together, and we really thought about development in the same way. And we developed exciting stories for donors, because what donors want most is to know that their dreams and aspirations for the institution will, in fact, be achieved. And that's what I think we, working with a whole lot of people at the institution and a whole lot of faculty and staff, were able to do.
Okay, you mentioned that Jerry May, in your opinion, the best fundraiser in the country, the best. Let's talk about another, the best. 2023-2024, the University of Michigan football season. Please.
Well, you know, that was somewhat of a surprise because we thought, oh my heavens, you know, entering the season and the coach is going to be suspended for some games. We knew that we had a good team. We knew we had a fabulous quarterback. And the season started, we started winning games. And by that time, I left because President Ono had been recruited to come to the institution. He came in mid-October. So the football season was really, you know, just getting started. But we kept winning and winning. And by that time, Ken and I had gone on to Denver, where we spend the winters. And it was just so exciting. I have to say, we were in our home in Denver, sort of jumping up and down and screaming at the television. We kept winning games. It was terrific.
While you were at Michigan as the president, you went to Pasadena, California a couple times to play this game they call the Rose Bowl. What's the parade like, and what's that game like?
We went three times to the Rose Bowl, actually, and I was thrilled to be there because I'd watched the parade on TV. You know, for years I'd watched the games, but the idea that we could actually be in that stand in Pasadena and see a game, I never thought I'd be able to do that, so it was fun. I will tell you, though, that after getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning so that we could be driven over to the Rose Parade and sit in the stands and be cold for many hours, it's much better to watch it on TV. But it was a lot of fun, and we lost all of those games to USC, as you may recall. But even so, being there was... you know, it was terrific.
We've been talking to Mary Sue Coleman, who's a treasure and a phenomenal career at a number of different universities. And God still got great plans for her. So, Dr. Mary Sue Coleman, thanks for being a guest, and God bless.
Thank you, Jack.
Please join us next week. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spall.